how to actually help the development and the sustainability of those local food initiatives that we have seen emerging over the last years, and specifically to discuss a little bit how they can be, whether and if so, how they can be promoted externally. Because we know that a lot of them are starting from intrinsically motivated interests that often are not very sustainable, but there is a need to get them more, make them more sustainable, and to share the experiences to inspire others. So I will be talking a little bit about this question and how to potentially do that by drawing on the experiences of one project, the EdisitNet project, that probably you have heard about, but I can explain a little bit more in the presentation about this. I will tell you basically how we were working with setting up collaborative structures to work together to foster sustainability changes in local food systems, what were our experiences from those, and how we see the next steps in this respect. I guess there is not much need for me to repeat some of the facts that I already saw in some of the other presentations. We all know that food systems need to be changed. They're a major contributor to greenhouse emissions. They're also affecting the current water and land and biodiversity resources that we all depend on. A lot of the, more than half of the population of the Earth currently lives in cities. And it's expected to grow significantly by 2050. So it does make sense for actually cities to take the lead in maybe driving urban food system transformation. Actually, there are a lot of examples of urban food activists who have already recognize the need for that, and they have started to try to explore ways of driving this type of both behavioral changes but also physical changes by producing local food and shortening the transportation links. A lot of them are, as I said, are driven on intrinsic motivation, existing shared interests and goals, and long-term established trust and relationships. Increasingly, political commitments are being made in order to drive food transformations as well. But oftentimes, they're trying to kind of impose the development of this type of grassroots organizations, initiatives to contribute to supporting food transformations, and it is not at all clear whether and how this is possible because they take time. They are often with predetermined objectives that restrict the possibilities for endogenous growth and innovation. They oftentimes kind of work through externally imposed partnerships and so on. So there are lots of questions about whether stimulating externally this type of collaborative structures and partnerships to drive food transformations are possible. On the positive side, there is the knowledge, new networks, and the possibilities for for new resources that could be pluses. And in a way, through the project that I've been working on over the last 5 years, we've been experimenting with those processes, and I would like to share some of the results. So as I said, the EdisitNet project is a Horizon 2020 project that involves 34, probably more by now, partners. The idea of the project is to try to document, was to try to document existing urban food initiatives in a set of cities that we are working with, and to enable them to experiment, adapt, and improve the current practices and policies that they are using, and to use those as a basis for sharing the knowledge with others outside the project network. The idea of the project is built around the concept of edible city solutions, which refers to activities, measures, products, services that support and facilitate sustainable urban food production, distribution, consumption and use in the cities. The idea is that food is much more closer to people, and this makes edible nature-based solutions much more socially inclusive and acceptable, and through enable the engagement of people in those type of solutions, unlike possibly more engineering-based, nature-based solutions. So the idea was to see whether and how engaging people through those initiatives could lead to broader changes in the system, both in making cities more greener and more sustainable, but also food systems as a whole. We are working with partners from 12 countries, including 11 cities, different NGOs, SMEs, and research partners. But specifically, I would like to focus on the cities that we worked with. There were two types of cities at the time when the project was developed. The EU still had this kind of front-runner city, follower city approach, and thus, in a way, our cities were dealing with, there were two types of processes, I would say. There was a number of cities in Europe, like Oslo, actually, Rotterdam, Berlin, as well as Havana, who were experimenting with urban food transformation through living labs. And then another set of cities, a lot of them actually in the global south, as you can see in Carthage, Lome, Montevideo, Guangzhou, as well as in San Feliu in Spain and in San Peter in Slovenia. They were developing master plans on how to make their cities more edible. And we have one exception, Berlin, where there were both there were organizations working on both processes. One was the development of edible city master plans, and the other one was the establishment of living labs. So in order to support the establishment of this type of collaborative co-creation processes, basically part of my role was, and the role of my colleagues at RMIT Europe, was to develop some kind of generic governance guidelines to help the partners set up this type of collaborative groups of different types of stakeholders from different levels through which they could co-develop, co-create and co-design and implement together, on the one hand, both living labs and master plan, edible city master plans. We provided a kind of set of generic guidelines about the diversity of actors that should be included, the type of issues to consider when setting up this type of edible city teams, including the motivation of the people, the capacities, the networks, the relations they had, maybe the power that they could bring in, the possibilities also to enable future developments of the overall initiative. And we were also very focused on highlighting some of the basic principles behind the work of those city teams, such as building on existing strengths, transparent decision-making processes, and information about design to enable participation, inclusiveness of all kinds of socioeconomic groups that may be interested to join those activities, participatory decision-making processes, adaptability, reflexivity. Along with that, we also provided some kind of more logistical, so to say, suggested terms of references about possible divisions of roles and responsibilities, monitoring, evaluation, learning from the process, and how to ensure continuity. In order to support the maintenance and the growth and the development of those teams, we also facilitated the regular exchange between them as they kept growing and evolving. And it is, in fact, through this type of regular bi-monthly meetings that were organized where the different representatives from the different city teams were sharing their progress that kind of the data or this type of observational study comes from, because it is based on a kind of thematic analysis of the issues that were raised in the course of those numerous meetings over the last several years. I would just like to know that those are kind of preliminary results that we still need to discuss with the partners in order to see whether There are some other views or ways of interpreting them. So one notable conclusion I would say that was obvious already almost from the beginning was that there was a major difference in terms of how collaborative processes work if you're dealing with living labs as opposed to master plan development processes. And this was very closely linked to actually two aspects, one in particular, but two aspects that in a way were not openly addressed maybe at the beginning of the project. One was the motivation. There was like the assumption that people would be happy and interested to join those type of activities because obviously interest was one of the suggested criteria for selecting people to get engaged, but it did prove significantly more difficult to get people interested to engage in the development of edible city master plans on a volunteering basis, as opposed to engaging them actually in some of the living lab experiments. Partly because, and mainly actually, I would say, because the living labs provided the possibilities for tangible physical benefits, engagement with others, and also fun actually through the experience, while the master plan development process was not so, I mean, the benefits from those were not so obvious and so tangible, and they made actually engagement in those processes a little bit harder to motivate. The other aspect was limited time. So limited time, and that affected in fact partly the overall design of the project, where cities were like from that were experimenting with living labs were supposed to share their knowledge with the ones who were designing master plans. On the one hand, that was actually great because this original setup created some kind of almost an unequal starting base that was not necessarily the case or well perceived and accepted. So those processes ran in parallel. There was exchange between them, but maybe there was not as much sharing of knowledge and learning across the cities as there could have been. But there was the issue of time also within each of the cities, because obviously time is needed to build a shared language, to agree on shared goals, to learn, to trust the others. It also proved more problematic in the master plan development processes because it was more closely linked to potentially restrictive municipal rules, maybe steeper learning curves with co-development, co-creation processes, as opposed to in the living lab processes where I guess the action, the work was much more hands-on oriented, and although there was time needed to reach a shared agreement on what the living lab would focus on, once this was agreed on, implementation kind of went underway faster and moved in faster, shorter-term cycles of work. Reconciling different interests was another kind of challenge. That worked out differently in the two types of processes. In the master plan development process, I guess the existing hierarchical structures and established firm responsibilities made it harder to reconcile different interests, while in the living labs, a lot of oftentimes kind of those different interests were seen as an opportunity to try out something new and learn. This is also linked to some of kind of the rules that presented the work of living labs as experimental and open to failure, while the master plan development process was seen as leading to the development of a document that everybody needs to agree on, that's not necessarily open to change once it is agreed on. The predefined goals that come with this type of externally motivated, so to say, initiatives and experiments also were important, but actually, interestingly enough, it worked out differently because in the living labs and the master plan development processes, because with the master plan development process, it was decided that the master plan is a concept that's open to interpretation. So people were given fairly large scope of freedom to define what it would be, while oftentimes the living labs had been kind of very much focused already in the description of the grant agreement that was signed with the EU. So it made it hard because then it was supposed to lead to very tangible impact that had to be also included in the grant agreement. So that actually made it sometimes harder for living labs to experiment more openly with whatever different stakeholders that were brought in to participate would propose. But this is not to say that it didn't work. On the other hand, it was still I guess a matter of structuring the process. Change of staff was another major challenge, oftentimes in the master plan development process, because municipalities were much more strongly involved. Those changes were politically driven, and they were linked to broader changes in structures, and they were delays with replacements, so not in all cases. While at the Living Lab level, there was a much larger number of people committed to the process and engaged and aware and familiar with it. So even if there were staff changes, they were not so hard to deal with, or so critical, so to say. And in terms of external factors, and obviously in our case, this was COVID-19. In the master plan development process, the reduced possibility for in-person exchange was kind of, there was an attempt to deal with that through the use of digital tools, but that did not necessarily work out for all, because then it privileged certain stakeholders and left others out of the process. While with the Living Labs, I guess initially they were much more strongly affected by the impossibility to meet in person, because a lot of the work that they had to do had to be physical, but then they recovered faster once, in a way, the restrictions were lifted and they could go to the field and start working. As I said, apart from kind of challenges, this type of collaborative process also bring opportunities. Knowledge, obviously, new knowledge is one of them. And in the master plan development process, bringing in different stakeholders that would not normally maybe have met allowed for. On the one hand, trying a new, different type of planning process that was much more participatory and open, which was a new learning opportunity in itself. It also allowed access to a broader pool of knowledge and ideas. In terms of the Living Lab, the knowledge that was kind of generated was much more focused on self-organizations, establishment of new relations, and much more specific. Opportunities in terms of new income generating opportunities related to urban food initiatives or testing out of new technologies. With networks, I guess in the master plan development process, bringing in different stakeholders allowed municipal authorities, for example, to gain a closer understanding, a better understanding of actually local actors and their capacities and needs. That could then later on potentially be better addressed, thus leading to more efficient outcomes, although we don't know whether this is going to happen. While in the Living Lab processes, they were still stakeholders that were engaged in those processes, allowed for accessing actors maybe with more power and authority that otherwise would have not been. Probably it would have been difficult to engage them. This was seen as a positive outcome of some of those processes. And in terms of resources, again, in the Living Labs, the different stakeholders involved could start to bring in their resources in the implementation of small, ongoing, short-term activities. Well, this was not necessarily the case in the master plan, although. Because there were no implementation there. But also, it opened up the potential for maybe longer term financing opportunities of the Living Labs. But again, that's not clear. And in a way, this leads me to the conclusion that, in a way, the two processes, obviously, with respect to some aspects, the Living Lab collaborative processes work better than the master plan development ones. And the other way around. But one of the major, I would say, conclusion is, to me at least, is that those processes should have been actually linked together, because in a way the learning takes place through a process of doing and thinking and reflecting and then going back and doing again. And in a way it, they were artificially separated within the project. So ideally future opportunities should allow for that. In terms of more concrete, kind of going back, if I go back to the type of original principles that we had developed and proposed as a basis for the development of those city teams and collaborative structures, I guess one general reflection is that, I mean, knowledge, once it's extracted as a good practice, for example, it becomes a little bit disembodied, and what is needed is to bring it back and connect it to the reality. So obviously the two aspects that I would say were not addressed openly from the beginning, motivation and time, would need to be considered. It's essential to get the incentives right from the beginnings, set up, kind of make sure that you're providing tangible benefits and equitable sharing of costs and benefits for people to stay motivated and engaged. In terms of time, when you're dealing with this type of experiments, actually, probably it's important to, when you have limited time, to start with existing structures, relations, and knowledge and grow organically around them in order to build on what is already there. When it comes to the generic kind of recommendation that we had on transparency, in fact, it should go much beyond that. It should not be focused on inclusivity and transparency. It cannot be ensured, but just by providing information, you should really make an active effort to remove the barriers to participation by whether it's organizing meetings at a time when, not during the working time, when there maybe only a few officials can attend, but in the evenings when other people, civil society representatives could join after work. In terms of also participation, it is more about building trust and a culture of responsiveness, recognizing and addressing people's needs, not only giving them an opportunity to raise them, ensuring that people get engaged and remain engaged also is more focused on making them feel useful rather than giving them tasks, allowing them to come up with their own version of or ideas about how they could contribute and get engaged in order to generate this type of more intrinsic motivation for engagement. Adaptability, again, is crucial, but the important thing is not to fix the what, but maybe to fix the commitment to openness and experimentation and learning from failure, as opposed to reaching concrete outcomes. And reflexivity is also essential, but in this respect, we should be moving from monitoring to learning and building in capacities and commitment to reflection to enable this type of learning, adaptation, and change. Apart from basically this type of meta knowledge or reflection, so to say, about how to set up and manage collaborative structures, a wide range of much more thematically focused knowledge was generated by the different cities about the use of urban spaces in order to make them more edible, how to integrate edible city solutions in more marginal neighborhoods, how to deal with urban food production and heritage, education, circular systems, and also network development. And all of those, apart from that knowledge, also the project generated a lot of new connections through the organization of different of two major conferences, actually. And it also allowed for growing inspiration by launching two rounds of awards where different initiatives that were kind of assessed in three categories: the most innovative individual action, the most innovative social engagement process, and the best overall edible city approach were collected. We had two rounds, and the initial one was a trial internal one, and second one was open to anybody, and it allowed for, we collected about 40 applications. So I just wanted to raise those last elements of the project, because all of this knowledge that was generated will now be collected and made accessible in the integrated online platform that I believe Joseph will tell you a little bit more about, because this will potentially, after the end of the project, remain the space where people can continue to learn from our experiences. Yes, I believe the network and the people that we have managed to reach out through the process is the real wealth that we have managed to create. From 34 partner organizations, we managed to reach out to you know, 1,000, more than close to 2,000 individuals from 80 different cities in 70 different countries. So I believe there is now the next step is how to actually keep all those people that have shown their interest and engaged and learning and sharing and exchanging. And I would stop here and let you, Joseph, tell you how we could potentially do that later on. Thank you.